Welcome to Neurotransmissions, SFN special episode number one.
So we went to Neuroscience 2016, the big neuroscientist meeting with about 30,000 people this year, and we recorded for our podcast.
Yeah, we set up a booth in the MPFI Information Center and brought a bunch of people from different walks of life to come talk to us about their careers, everything from science communication and journalism to policy and grant making. Maybe I wasn't there for that. And science. So we have a lot of different episodes coming out pretty soon.
So we thought we'd organize it and piecemeal it out to you guys so you can hear a bit of each different kinds of discussions that we had at SFN.
You'll notice that there's a lot of background noise. That's how you guys know it's real.
Yeah.
We were recording on the convention floor, so...
Yeah, it's an agoraphobe's worst nightmare.
That's right.
It's a crazy conference.
And terrible for Joe.
It's scientists just take over whatever city they go to when they have these conferences. It's a lot of fun. You get to catch up with old friends and see what everybody in your field is up to. So, but what do we have on the docket today?
Well, today I think we're going to talk about how to communicate scientists, and we're going to talk to two different people in different walks of life in scientific communication.
So first we sat down with John Hamilton. John is an award-winning journalist working for the science desk at National Public Radio. He talks about how to put a story together for a broad audience and what scientists can do to be more effective communicators. Let's take a listen. We have a very special guest sitting down with us today. John Hamilton is a correspondent for National Public Radio's Science Desk. He reports on neuroscience, health, climate challenges, a lot of science that is really critical to the human experience. So we're glad to have a new, fresh perspective on the role of neuroscience in society here. So John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah. So what is neuroscience like for somebody who isn't a scientist, who is just here to report on all the goings-on and stuff?
Well, it can be a little overwhelming. A lot of the talks here are pretty technical. And as an English major, I can say that there are certainly times I'm way out of my depth.
So how do you decide what becomes a story that you're particularly interested in, that you find compelling to report about?
Well, for me, so much of what I do has to have some relevance to people. And so there's a lot of this meeting that is really basic science. And a lot of that I look at, I'm interested in, but I don't report on. So often when I'm coming here, I'm looking to see, are there things that are relevant to especially the diseases, the brain diseases people are most interested in? So things have to do with autism and Alzheimer's and Parkinson, things like that. The other thing I look for often is stories that give some insight into how our brains work, how learning happens, that kind of stuff.
And so how did you become interested in science reporting to begin with? Because there's a lot of different types of journalism. You're an English major. Like, what was the hook for you about reporting on scientific research in the United States?
Well, to be fair, I always was interested in science, even though I was an English major. But when I went to journalism school, I ended up taking the science writing specialization. And the reason was I found the reporting interesting, and what really sold me on it was as a young reporter thinking about making medicine and science the area I really wanted to concentrate on. I was doing a story about aspirin, and this is back in the 1980s, and I was doing a story about aspirin, and I called up somebody I thought would know something about it. It happened to be a guy named Sir John Vane, who had won the Nobel Prize for explaining aspirin, and he answered his own phone and he talked to me at length, and I thought, these are the kind of people I want to be interviewing for the rest of my career.
So is that the typical process about how you interface with scientific information, is going directly to researchers, or does a lot of it come from press releases, or is it in a more distilled format?
Well, there are a lot of people who send me press releases, so I see quite a few press releases. I certainly read the big journals, Science and Nature and PNAS and PLOS, that whole bit. I read Neuron, you know. I try to keep track of that stuff. But I will say many of the ideas I get from discussions with brain scientists. And it seems like every time I do a story, in the course of reporting that story, I will talk to somebody who will say something that tells me what the next story I should do is.
So It also seems there you have a couple challenges in just the general job you have, because not only do you have to be fluent in science to the degree where you can understand complex, you know, topics that a bunch of basic science researchers are working on, but you also have to be able to translate that in a way that the general public is going to be able to appreciate. So I wonder, what do you see as the central goal in communicating this information to the public? Like, is it purely to inform, or is it to generate excitement about certain ideas, or?
Well, it's obviously to inform. I mean, the challenge for me is finding things that not only do I find interesting and neuroscientists find important, but are things that our audience is interested in. And of course, now that we have a lot of the visits to NPR via our website now, so we can track what people are interested in, what they're not. So I'm often looking for things that I can present in a way that is accessible to people, things that can be told through human stories. Often the human stories are not necessarily about like individuals with a brain condition. Often the individual story is about the scientists themselves. And I have encouraged brain scientists especially often to tell me the story of their research as opposed to presenting their results in a dry fashion. And I find when they do that, it engages people.
Yeah, and so I wonder also if you are able to sort of track the traffic on websites and you know what types of stories people tend to key in on. Like, for a neuroscientist, who are the people that are getting a lot of the hits these days? I mean, is it mostly disease-related stuff, or is it also just neurotechnology and that sort of thing?
People are interested in things that go well beyond disease. People are fascinated by, for instance, brain-computer interfaces, robotics and prosthetics, that whole thing. Those stories get a whole lot of traffic, and partly because people are fascinated with the potential of that type of technology, partly I think they're sort of apprehensive and worried about some of the implications of that, and I often get, back before we discontinued comments on stories. I used to get a lot of comments when I would do those types of stories, noting how much of the funding came from, you know, defense agencies and that kind of thing. People are apprehensive about it.
So this might come across as a weird question, but I think from my perspective as somebody who works at the bench, I don't necessarily always get, you know, a really accurate feedback or readout of how, you know, energized the general public is about science. And it seems like there's, you know, nowadays sometimes feelings of sort of an anti-intellectual climate, you know, people who deal in the minutiae of figuring out the truth about things are often, you know, people are very skeptical of, you know, elite ivory tower type people. So I don't know if you can comment on whether or not that's, you know, a real phenomenon, but in this sort of new age of changing media and stuff, like, is the general way in which you try to engage your audience changing over time? Are people are you having to tailor your message in order to combat those types of?
I am aware of what you're talking about when I do stories, and I should say that, I mean, on the one hand, I'm very lucky. The NPR audience tends to be highly educated, tends to like science, but not always. You know, we often think of anti-science as being, say, climate change deniers and that whole group of people who are often associated with the conservative politics and that sort of thing. However, on the other side, I'm more likely to have NPR listeners who are skeptical of things like vaccines. Say there is definitely that element, and in fact, often when I'm doing stories, I have very much in mind that I'm aware there's a certain resistance to some of the things I'm talking about from that group of people.
And you know, I think one of the things that scientists don't do very well, and it's something that I personally try to work on. I try to give talks to the public and that sort of thing. But people, you know, scientists aren't necessarily good at distilling the basic message of their research down in a way that people that don't have a science degree can understand. So there's like 30,000 people at this meeting right now. I've been to a lot of posters, and even though I study things similar, sometimes I'm getting confused by what they're talking about. So what can scientists do in particular to help bridge this gap between science and the general public from your perspective?
There are definitely a number of things that scientists can do. One is to realize that the, say, for instance, the order of information as presented in a scientific paper is often sort of upside down from what you'd be saying if you were having a conversation with somebody. So you have to kind of get out of that mode. I occasionally teach classes in science communication to scientists. And one of the things I often point out to them is that, you know, if scientists discovered a lizard on Mars, that information would be buried at the end of the paper after a lot of stuff about methodology and background, right? All these kinds of things. And they got to get out of that. You have to interest people with the bottom line. You say, well, I found a lizard on Mars. Then they'll want to know how, why, what's your evidence?
So what exactly is the level of detail that people tend to want to be interested in? Is it in the basic methodologies of stuff, or is it the big picture that people really want to get out of science?
Well, people want to know. They want to know what they want to start off knowing what the discovery was. Usually, when you're talking to a journalist, certainly in the news part of our business, it's because you have a new paper out. There's a new finding. They want to know what that is. But beyond that, I think they want scientists to give them more help with the context of that discovery. How does this fit into the larger area of research that you're in? I think often scientists will talk in very, very narrow terms about what they've found, and feeling like it's beyond their expertise to branch beyond that. But in fact, they know so much more than the average journalist or the average member of the public that it's really helpful when you say, well, and the reason this is a meaningful finding is that here's this narrative of this journey that this part of science has been on, and here's where it fits into this, and here's where we think it's going, that kind of stuff.
And so as somebody who has, I know that your reporting goes well beyond neuroscience. You talk about the climate, you talk about, you know, extreme weather events and other types of health problems. But you've been following neuroscience pretty closely. From a journalistic perspective, what do you think have been some of the bigger changes in the direction that the field of neuroscience has gone over the course of your reporting? I mean, it seems like, you know, we went through a boom in the early 2000s where people were really focused on technology development, optogenetics, and things like that. And I mean, do you see a general trajectory in where neuroscience has gone over the course of your reporting on it?
I definitely see some changes. And of course, you know, neuroscience has just been exploding for the 10 years. It's an incredibly busy field, to wit, this meeting with 30,000+
right.
people at it. But some of the directions that I've seen, I mean, there are booms and busts. You know, there's a huge amount of excitement, for instance, over the early understanding of Alzheimer's disease and, you know, plaques in the brain, this kind of thing. And then a huge disappointment when that turned out not to be the complete picture and drugs failed and that kinds of things. So there are booms and busts in interest. I would say the thing that is really changing is the intersection of neuroscience and other fields. And I mean, way far other fields, like neuroscience and philosophy are intersecting in really interesting ways. You have people, neuroscientists now, who are worried about the biological underpinnings of consciousness,
right?
That kind of stuff. And then, you know, more practical clinical setting, you have neuroscientists who are working with psychologists and psychiatrists, figuring that even something like talk therapy, if it's working, you should be able to see biological changes in the brain. And that seems to be a direction we're moving.
Cool. Well, John Hamilton, I just want to take the opportunity to thank you again for sitting down with us, and enjoy the rest of your SFN.
Actually, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
That was a fantastic interview, Joe.
Oh, thanks. Thanks to Mr. Hamilton for sitting down and talking to us. I felt like I grabbed him out of a busy part of a hectic meeting schedule. So we really appreciate his time.
Yeah, and his insight on reporting for NPR. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very
cool. Right. So one more person that we actually sat down with is somebody who's in a very similar position to us. He does a neuroscience podcast called Brain Matters. Brain Matters was around for about 3 years now, and he does it out of the University of Austin in Texas. And it is Anthony Lacania. So he's a grad student there, and we got to chat with him about his podcast. So let's listen to that. So Anthony is the host of Brain Matters, a podcast from UT. He's a grad student there right now.
That's right, yeah.
And host and...
Producer, editor, music selector. I do almost everything except There's another host named Matt Davis. He does all the, like, we swap off hosting. And then we have Lauren Krieger, who is sort of the executive producer, edits a lot of the episodes. But we kind of trade off all of our, whenever we have free time.
So for people who are interested in kind of getting into this, I think a lot of people, specifically grad students, would be really afraid that they wouldn't have time or they get fired. I always like kind of promote the idea of podcasting because I think it's like the most amazing career opportunity. You know, like, what better thing do you have to do with an hour of your time than talk one-on-one with one of the biggest names in your field?
It's right? Amazing. Yeah, I can't believe they let me do that. We just came up with the idea, hey, there's these professors that are here. They were visiting. That kind of was the impetus for our idea. There's so many universities that invite, you know, fantastic neuroscientists or any scientists to their university to give talks to the, you know, careerists, so people that are in the field. And it was inspired by, there was someone coming, I wish I could remember who, but the topic was so interesting, I wanted to invite some of my friends that weren't neuroscientists, and I realized this would not be useful to them because they're going to be talking very, you know, specifically to the, you know, to the other neuroscientists in the field. So be using all the jargon, and it wouldn't be an open environment. And so I went, well, they're going to be here. It would be wonderful if we could take them somewhere else and just have it be a, you know, let's, what if it was an auditorium with a, you know, a larger audience? And we realized that would be asking of so much of them. But then we thought podcasting, oh my God, we should just bring them in a room, talk to them one-on-one, and, you know, that would be more comfortable and easier to coordinate. And then, yeah, we could then put it out there for people to appreciate.
And the most surprising thing about it, I mean, is that these people that come to talk to you, everybody, almost everybody says yes, right? People are excited to talk.
One person, maybe.
Yeah, we've had one person say no, you know, other than, you know, obviously time issues are time issues, but...
I feel so grateful. As everyone's been, when I throw it out, sometimes they're like, I don't know what that is. What's a podcast? But everyone has been super generous with their time. And anyways.
Yeah. And do you know either you or maybe it's too early in your grad school time and maybe you don't want your boss to hear, but how does podcasting kind of and doing this and getting into sort of more media and getting this kind of, I guess, communications experience. I mean, are you considering this to be a part of your career in the future, or do you think it's going to stay a hobby? Do you think it's going to be a tool that you can use?
I want to say, like, so that when I come back in 10 years, I'll be like, this is going to be the thing I do forever. And then we'll be able to be like, yes, he knew it then. But no, honestly, I have no idea. I totally would like to continue this. No matter where, like, what it turns into. I know a lot of people, you got kind of at the question of, like, how do people make time to do something like this in a busy, especially graduate students, where we're tasked with ungodly amounts of sort of, like, work to do, and fitting in any sort of thing that seems frou-frou is, like, sometimes looked down upon. I found it to be not only beneficial to me to, like, have some sort of external creative thing to work on. So, you know, you put in the hours when you can find them. So we are doing this. I'm editing at, you know, 11 o'clock at night before I'm going to bed. It's stressful, and maybe I get worse sleep because of it, but it's a good outlet. And then also, I really feel that scientists, we should be, you know, we have a responsibility, I think, to talk about what we do and communicate it correctly. And I think having people from all rings, you know, graduates at every level that at least can talk to people maybe at their same level or, you know, have a voice at that level of their career is important. I think all scientists need to kind of at least take, you know, no one, not everyone has to do stuff like this. That's what I'm saying, but at least consider it if you have time and have a passion for it.
Absolutely. So it's, you know, it's great for you and it's great for kind of science advocacy and sharing information between your own colleagues as well. So throughout your experience, you've been doing this for
we just hit our 3 year.
3 years, right? Mm-hmm. So who's your favorite person that you've ever talked to?
Oh man, that's a tough question.
I'll just say, which interview do you think came out after the editing process to be the best one?
Nobody's
offended.
Yeah, I hope not. I love each and every one of my podcast interviews like my children. I will say, I started editing them a little heavier in the last, like, couple years. When we started off, I had no idea what I was doing. I had never touched a recording audio interface in my entire life. So we kind of just would hit play, record on the computer, we'd get it out, and then we would kind of just like send it out like that. So if you go back, they sound kind of crappy. We are actually, I'm in the process of remastering the old episodes with a little bit of the techniques I've learned. I just use YouTube to, you know, look at how to do compression and equalization. So I'm totally an amateur, but it doesn't take a lot of time to make it sound a lot better. But anyways, to get back at your real question, I would say that I think Yael Niv was an interview that turned out one of the best because she didn't even know she was going to do it. I kind of like ran up on her at a conference and asked if she could just come back and like talk. And she was actually almost like hesitant to say yes. And then as soon as she got in, it was, I think it's one of the longest episodes we had because we were somehow, I think we're on a very similar page, even experimentally. So that one was great. I also really enjoyed Massimo Scanziani was a fantastic guest too. And he really opened up, I think, halfway through the interview and started talking. I love when the guests start kind of telling their stories of success and failure and what it took to kind of become where, you know, to I think like change the trajectory to get to where they really are now. I love those stories.
Yeah, that's definitely the best part of the interview. You can tell like halfway through when either you manage to ask the right question or they just let their guard down enough and they feel comfortable enough and they start like laughing and getting really into whatever.
That's the
whatever
best. If we
about,
can, that's yeah. what I try to at
that's
any point.
Into, yeah. Yeah. It's really funny that you say that you started out just kind of putting them out straight out there and then yeah. you started editing later on. I think we, at this point, I think we're sort of the opposite. We started doing heavily editing in the beginning because our interviews were so terrible and no. we would ask like dumb questions and we would keep on.
Wait, did you put out your very first interview you ever did? Like, we have some that we did, nice practice, and no one will ever see them.
We did one that was practice that was with one other postdoc that like no one will ever see that. But for us, it was really tough because we started this whole thing when it was time for the neuroimaging course in our institute. By the way, check out the neuroimaging course at our institute.
Plug.
plug. But we had all these big people coming, and we were like, well, you know, we should talk to them. And that was like, it was happening like a week after we got all this stuff together, you know? And it was Jeff Lichtman was the first person we talked to who I knew from seeing his last day of SFN presidential lecture to everybody. And then the next person we talked to was Eric Betzig, the winner of a Nobel Prize.
That was an awesome interview, by the way.
I loved it. He's a kooky guy, I guess I would describe him, you know?
And I'm not even kidding. After I watched after I listened to your interview with him, I then went on like a YouTube binge of watching like every talk that
everything
he had done because I was
yes.
like, I don't. He was so charming. I was like, oh my God, this
yeah.
guy's great.
Absolutely, he'll make you like rethink everything about Nobel. But it's really funny. Like we actually interviewed two people off of that Nobel Prize, and they couldn't be the two most different people in the entire
really?
World.
Really?
I guess I don't want to get into exactly what makes them different because I don't want to insult anybody. But they're both wonderful scientists in their own way.
Yeah.
Obviously, because that's why they got Nobel Prizes. yeah, so we had to pretend, hey, friends are waving to me, I'm very popular. plug for me.
More plugs, baby.
Yeah. We had to pretend with all of them that we knew that we were doing, and, you know, it was lucky for us that they, it's not like they Googled the podcast, they were way big for this. So, you know, we were like, oh, yeah, you know, this is usually what we do, you know, in sort of insanely big person. This is not the first interview that we're doing. No problem.
That's intimidating. Oh, my God, just immediately right off the bat talking to some like big names. But I mean, you guys, by the way, I love your guys' show.
Oh, thank you.
You guys are fantastic.
You guys are our inspiration. So we really appreciate that.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is there anything you would like to plug?
Oh, yeah, Brain Matters. Check out Brain Matters. We're a podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Brainpodcast.com is our website. We got a Twitter. I think it's at Brain Podcast. What else do I want to plug? I put in a lot of time for the music part. It's probably like I'm a big music dude, so at the end of every episode, I put in music. So I'm plugging all the artists that I feature on those. I try to get either Austin local bands or just other artists that I enjoy, and I will just send them I kind of feel like I just put their music in and not tell them, but I'm sure that's probably a copyright infringement. So I ended up, I spent a lot of time just like reaching out to people, asking them for their music, and almost everyone also says yes to that. So plug to all the musicians that I've featured. I love you guys.
So the takeaway from this is, if you just want people to say yes to all the time, have a podcast and it'll happen. Stick a microphone in somebody's face.
People love it.
People love it.
I was just walking by and then you said, hey, sit down. And of course I said yes. And now I'm sitting in front of a microphone. I can't say no. You're right.
That's selection bias, though. You are a podcast host.
I've never been interviewed before, too. I almost instinctually started asking you questions.
That's all right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for talking.
Appreciate it, Michael.
All right. Well, that was the end of special episode number one. I'm pretty pumped about podcasting, guys.
Yeah. I hope everybody learned a little bit about reporting neuroscience, if that's what I guess we can call this. But
yeah, and thanks to our guests, Anthony and John Hamilton.
It was a real pleasure.
Yeah. Absolutely. Anthony, I'm sorry I'm not saying your last name just because I can't pronounce it.
That's right. Thank you to everybody in the MPFI Communications Department for making this happen, especially Miguel, who took care of getting all the equipment to and from SFN and setting all the recording up for us. That was incredibly helpful. Thank you to Marlena Fernandez for scripting out everything that happened in the interviews for us. Also very useful. And thank you to the Institute as a whole.
Yeah, thanks to Jennifer Gutierrez for setting up the interview with Mr. Hamilton, and to Helena Decker and Miriam Chun for helping schedule all this stuff for the SFN episode.
Yeah, if it wasn't for all these people, you know, this wouldn't have happened. So we're really grateful.
Stay tuned for more SFN episodes. We have a couple in store for you, and we are very excited to bring you guys this material.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Follow us at NeuroPodcast on Twitter, and also follow us on Facebook, and follow us...
Actually, please stop following me in real life.
Honestly, it's
that was not a joke last week.
Not funny anymore, you guys.
Okay.
Quit it. Bye.
Bye. Bye.